K-Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome, K-Mud listeners. This is Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. I'm excited to have another wonderful EPIC edition of the K-Mud Environment Show. We are going to cover two different subjects tonight. First, we're going to talk about restoration forestry. If that seems, what is the term? Disjointed. It's not. And so we'll have Ben Blum from Save the Redwoods League on in just a moment to talk about the league's work in helping to restore our redwood ecosystems. And then we're going to go to Sacramento. We're going to check in with Alex Loomer of Loomer Consulting about this current legislative session. What's going on? What's the word in Sacramento? What are the enviro bills that EPIC and others should be watching? But first, let's talk about restoration forestry. Ben Blum, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's first introduce you and then let's introduce the league. So Ben, tell us about yourself. How did you get to start working at Save the Redwoods League? How are you interested in redwoods? I don't believe that you're from the Redwoods.
No, I grew up on the East Coast. Didn't know anything about forestry growing up. Didn't really have access to forests really at all. I grew up in the Boston area in Massachusetts. I kind of on a whim was looking for jobs when I had just graduated from college and found a job in Mendocino County. And that was my first time coming to California. And I lived up kind of north of Westport, way up in the mountains. And, first experience with redwood forests. And I kind of fell in love with them. Ended up kind of going away, getting a master's degree in forestry and then coming back and lived up in Humboldt for 4 or 5 years where I was the manager of Headwaters Forest there and outside Eureka. Continued to work for federal agencies for another 10 or 5 years or so after that. And then this position opened up with Save the Redwoods League to do restoration work. And so I jumped at it. I live down in Santa Cruz County. So not, a ways away, but it's the place that most reminds me of Humboldt down here on the Central Coast. So anyways, that's my backstory. So I've been in this position about 3 years now.
Cool. And you are the director of restoration, I believe, right?
Yeah. So our organization is centered around four main program areas. And so kind of the original part of Save the Redwoods League was kind of about buying properties and turning them into parks. And so, the organization over the first 100 years that it existed, protected over 250,000 acres. A lot of those are now our state parks, all up and down the Highway 101 corridor. But we also have a Connect program that focuses on bringing people out to those parks and connecting people with the redwoods. And then we have a science program that has a lot of great programs, research grant programs, also big initiatives like the Redwoods and Climate Change Initiative, where we've learned so much about redwoods and climate change. Redwood Genome Project, where we've actually helped sequence the genome of Coast Redwood and Giant Sequoia. And then my program, so the fourth of those programs is the Restore Program. And it's the biggest program at Save the Redwoods League now. And in the last 10 years, it's really grown. It's over half of the budget of the organization, really focused on building resilience and forest health back into our Coast Redwood and Giant Sequoia forests. So it's really exciting to be part of the organization as it's grown, focused on the restoration side of our mission. So,
well, and thank you to the league for its century plus of good work, right? We have 4% of the historic old growth redwood still left. And I think probably 3.9% of that is because of the league, or 98% of that 4% is probably because of the league. However you want to think about it, right. The league had for so long, as you mentioned, been in the business of acquiring redwood lands and turning them over into parks or some sort of conserved status. And as you said, the league has kind of shifted in recent years, and now the majority of the league's budget is going to restoring the redwoods. Can you talk about kind of why this evolution in the league's practice? What is driving this, shift in focus?
Yeah, I think there's a few things going on. I mean, one is that almost all of the old growth redwood now has been protected in some sort of park preserve. And so, you know, that caused a shift to where the organization started having to buy second growth forest and third growth forest. And so that kind of forced a little bit of an evolution. You know, you start buying these properties that have second, third growth, you know, unhealthy. They look very different than the forests, you know, that we used to acquire, like old growth forests, like Richardson Grove, all these places up and down the Highway 101 corridor. And so, you know, that was part of it. But I think the other part of it is just kind of a realization that restoration is critical if we're going to have forests like we are used to in the future. We had things like the CZU fire in 2020 down here in Santa Cruz that I had a firsthand experience with. You know, we're recognizing kind of that these are incredible systems, but they're fragile, just like all ecosystems. And so restoration is a way to kind of build, kind of help these forests tap into that natural resiliency that they have. And human influences have impacted everything at this point with climate change. And so, you know, we're cognizant of that. And, you know, we're working in these forests that takes a lot of squinting to think about how you can turn that back into an old growth or a mature forest again. But that's the exciting part of the position is that I get to kind of, you know, get these projects going where we're looking hundreds of years into the future to try to create mature forest again in a place, you know, where it's, like I said, it's kind of, you're really squinting to see how you could make that happen. And it takes many decades, but it's incredible work. And we've learned a lot over the years in terms of how to do restoration forestry and how to kind of accelerate these forests back into a more natural state. And so it's really exciting. That's kind of what I get to focus my days on.
Well, it's remarkable to have to think about forests in geologic time when so much of our life is in much shorter intervals to think like a mountain, as Aldo Leopold might say. It's difficult, but it's pretty fun too when you get to the hang of it. So restoration as employed by the League, I think a lot of people when they think of forest restoration work, they would probably think of like, a person with a backpack full of seedlings and they're going through the forest and they're planting a new forest. And like, isn't that great? And isn't that what we should be doing? We're fighting deforestation. In reality, the League's work is going to be very different from this. And it might look often very similar to the thing that degraded the forest in the first place. So the League is employing forestry practices to restore forests. Can you talk maybe a little bit about the kind of work that is being done under this Redwoods Rising program? I think maybe I spoiled a little bit for you, but the interesting nature of this kind of work.
So you're right. Yeah, it's different than a lot of people's impression when I talk to somebody about what I do. The first thing that comes to mind is replanting, right? And the irony of it is that we actually have too many trees. So, you know, when a redwood is cut, for example, it clones itself, right? And so one tree then becomes 10 sec, one old growth tree becomes 10, 15 second growth trees. And those trees are all in competition for light with each other. And they're all also in competition for light with other species, like Douglas fir and tan oak and others. And so the forest looks very different. And so, you know, typically what we're doing is thinning out those forests so that the trees have a chance to grow into big trees again. And when you walk into an old growth forest, there's a lot of things that you kind of notice when you walk in, and sometimes you notice them kind of unconsciously, right? So the trees are incredibly huge, right? So there's big trees. They're all different sizes, right? So there's like a variety of different trees in there of different ages, different sizes. There's big gaps in between clumps of trees, so it's not uniform at all. That's why you see when you go into redwood forest, it's so hard to take pictures, right? Because there's like speckled light and darkness, and it's non-uniform. And so, what we get after a lot of these industrial logging practices that happened is that those kinds of characteristics of the forest have been kind of flipped on their head. And so now, you know, we had, you know, fewer trees that were big. Now we have a lot of small trees. Then the kind of trees, the species that are there, is different than was there before logging. And it looks very uniform. It looks like a plantation, right? And so what we do with our practices is try to kind of reset these forests back on a trajectory towards what was there before. And we've done research with people from Cal Poly Humboldt and others to kind of understand, you know, how we can do that and the best practices for doing that. And so restoration forestry, particularly in the Redwood Range, has really grown as a discipline in the last 10 years. And when I was working at Headwaters 10 years ago, there was kind of a group of folks like Jason Terrioka from Redwood National Park, Lathrop Leonard from State Parks. All these people were kind of wrestling with the same thing. We've got these really uniform kind of zombie forests out there. And, you know, can we use the tools that we learned in forestry school to actually bring it back to something that was there before? And so there's been a lot of collaboration, like I said, with researchers to understand the best ways to do that. And now we're applying it, and we're doing it at pretty large scale. So Redwoods Rising, you mentioned, is our largest restoration project, kind of by size, by scale, by all sorts of metrics. It's a 70,000 acre project. It's incredibly ambitious. It's one of the largest restoration projects in the world. And the focus of that is to restore lands that were harvested prior to the creation of Redwood National and State Park. So a lot of folks don't know that 2/3 of Redwood National and State Parks, which is over 100,000 acres, was logged before it became part of the park. And so what we're doing is trying to set those forests back on a trajectory to be healthy, mature forests again that can support diverse wildlife, diverse plants, all those things that we come to love about redwood forests. And so it's a really amazing thing to be a part of, to be part of this huge effort. We've treated over 5,000 acres in the first 5 years of implementation there. And we've kind of created a model that's different than a lot of other restoration models that are kind of one-off projects. So with Redwoods Rising, it's like a 30-year project, and we're working and tweaking things over time and getting better at what we're doing and moving faster as we can to get things done. And the scale of it is really immense. And some of those impacts take a while. Like you go into one of these forests that we've thinned. And like I said, sometimes it takes a little squinting to recognize, you know, the trajectory that we just set it on. But there's other things that we do, like removing roads as part of that project. We've removed close to 40 miles of roads, old logging roads that are falling into the creeks and choking the creek with sediment. We've removed over close to 40 miles of road. And sometimes the year after we remove that road and the stream that was buried underneath that road is uncovered, we have cutthroat and steelhead spawning in those streams again. So it's pretty inspirational to be able to be a part of something like that with this kind of long-term 30-year vision, just hoping that whoever's in my position in 30 years gets to is thinking kindly about me. But I think they will be, hopefully.
Yeah, totally. Well, so I recently went out and looked at implementation on some Redwoods Rising projects. And I have to say, I thought that the work was beautifully done. I went to a couple of different stands. One had a lot of remnant old growth still in it, individual trees, that is. These were, you know, at the time, unmerchantable. We had so much other old growth redwood, so we'll just pass by this tree that might have kind of a twist to it, or like weird branching that would make it difficult to mill. We'll just get past that. Now it's fantastic that we still have these legacies left, because they form kind of this complex feature that helps, you know, age the forest faster in some sense. You know, we have structure still left in the forest, and then we are kind of restoring the rest of the forest around them. I saw that, and it was beautiful. I also saw another stand, which was, you know, maybe 60 years old or so, pretty small trees. And you could see when looking at the stumps that the trees were really impacted, that they had tight growth rings, which, you know, we like an old growth, but for these young trees, it's a sign that there's a lot of competition, that they're fighting for resources, they're fighting for light. And one thought that I had when looking at this is that, you know, nature would do its job in time, right? This competition is going to result in winners and losers. And in time, some trees will die because they'll be outcompeted and their brethren will be able to take off and become bigger. But it might take a while. And the logging seemed to just cut out that step, that instead of kind of waiting for nature to do its thing and for trees to die as a result of competition, here we can go in and we can start to restore a more healthy number of trees per acre, crown structure, all of these sorts of things that we know and love in a redwood forest. So kudos to you, kudos to your team. It was it was really cool to see. But maybe you want to also perhaps provide a response to the people who say, why don't we just let these forests do their own thing, especially in a state or national park, right? I know a lot of people are uneasy about the idea that we would take out trees from a national park, from Redwood National Park, even if it's well-meaning. This might be a slippery slope in which we start to log the old growth or some other dumb idea. So why is this sort of restoration good, and how can the public know to trust what you're doing?
Yeah, so those stands that you went to, Tom, were logged probably in the late 60s. So we're talking about 60 years ago. And, you know, they're not healthy. They look very different. And there's untreated stands that you probably went by as well and saw kind of what it looked like. So there's no sunlight hitting the forest floor. There's no biodiversity in the understory.
There's no diversity in the trees either.
In the trees, know? Yeah. So it's kind of a monoculture.
Yeah, it's kind of a plantation.
Yeah. And so Jerry Franklin, he's a researcher out of the University of Washington, kind of the godfather of restoration forestry. We took him out to Redwoods Rising a couple years ago, which was this kind of magical moment. And he talked about, you know, that we're in the game of turning what is not a forest. He calls these plantations, they are not forests, back into forests again. And there's nothing we could do that would be more impactful in our lives than doing that. And we're creating new forests. And when he drives by a place that he says is a plantation, he's like, these are not forests. Do not think of them as forests. Think of them as agricultural fields. We're turning these back into forests and trying to bring that diversity back. If you don't have sunlight reaching the forest floor, you don't have understory plants that produce berries, for example, that birds can feed on. So even the wildlife biodiversity in these untreated stands is incredibly low. They're kind of like deserts for wildlife. So not a lot of wildlife go through there. There's just because there's nothing for them there, right? And so we can leave these forests in kind of that state of suspended animation for many, many decades. And that was a 60-year-old stand that you were in. We have other stands that are kind of 70 years old. They look pretty similar, but you'll see more trees starting to die over time, and there'll be little gaps forming, but that process can take hundreds of years. And we don't know that we have that much time. We only have 4% of old growth remaining, and most of the redwoods that are not protected right now are still being actively managed for logging. And so we're trying to set more of these forests back into a more mature forest type, which is actually incredibly rare in the redwood range when you think about it. And so we also just don't know what the climate's going to look like in 100 years. And these forests that are unhealthy, where they're in competition for light, those trees themselves are really susceptible to things like disease, wind throw, to fire. So, you know, a tree is kind of like a person, right? Like if you're hand to mouth your whole life, all you have, you're making just enough money to feed yourself. you know, when the next Great Depression happens, you're in a tough place, right? So a tree that doesn't have enough access to light is an incredible competition just to grow, just to get a little bit of sunlight. They're putting all their effort into growing up and skinny, right? When they have enough access to sunlight, they can grow out. They can grow horizontally. And that's incredibly important when a fire comes through, right? So that horizontal growth builds up bark. It builds up heartwood. That allows the tree to be more resilient in the face of things like wildfire and drought and bugs. And so, you know, we saw that, for example, in the fires in Santa Cruz in 2020, in the places where we had fewer trees per acre with bigger trees, the forest did much better than they did in places where we had more and smaller trees. And that's because those trees, they don't have the resilience that the bigger trees have. And we've done some research. It's really interesting how these trees do this. But in Santa Cruz and Big Basin, for example, fire comes through, and within months, they're shooting out new buds, right? And so, how does a tree do that, right? So it's not photosynthesizing; it's not getting energy, yet it has these reserves, right? And so it's shooting out these new buds. And we found that some of the carbon in those buds can be over 50 years old, up to 100 years old. So this is carbon that the tree is taking from the atmosphere, putting into these buds. It's like a savings, right? They're putting it into savings for something to happen, right? And if you don't have enough sunlight to put your reserves into savings, you're less resilient in the case of a fire, right? And so these trees are incredible, but we really have to, you know, we have a role. We created these problems as humans, and we have a role in making them healthy again. So that's the way I see things. And sometimes it takes getting out there and kind of seeing, you know, a stand 5 years since we thinned to kind of see how it's filling back in and how the understory has come back and how those trees that are now getting sunlight are resprouting all along the bowl and just happy trees. And you could take a core of that tree and see the growth rings expanding again. So it's pretty exciting to be part of that.
So we are at the beginning of an experiment, which is going to be measured in centuries and not years or decades even. So we are at the beginning, but there have been some kind of work done in the past that we can look to see that we're in the right direction. Can you talk about some of the past kind of restoration work, historic work that is kind of the inspiration for what we're doing now and how we know that we're headed in the right direction?
Yeah. So some of the earlier, you know, so when Redwood National and State Parks was created, you know, part of the mission of the Park Service kind of unique was that restoration was always envisioned as being part of this because they were acquiring these forests literally as the timber companies were logging them. So there was a recognition that these were not natural conditions. And so there were some early experiments with thinning work, for example. There was always a road decommissioning project as part of Redwood National Park. And that kind of was more consistent over the years. But there were some initial attempts to do some thinning work in Redwood National Park back in the 70s. That got shut down because people were just not comfortable with the idea of doing this kind of work in a national park.
It was too soon, you know.
It was too soon. Yeah.
You're already, right?
Yeah. And there's this great story about when Save the Redwoods League purchased the Mill Creek addition to Del Norte Redwood State Park, which is now a big part of Redwoods Rising. That was a logged forest. The board went to go visit the forest that they had just acquired. It was a 30,000 acre acquisition, huge acquisition. And State Parks was doing some thinning there to try to experiment with how do we get this forest back? And board members were crying, just not comfortable with this idea. And I think over time, you know, we've done smaller projects to kind of just understand, you know, how this can work and bring people out to show them what the result is. And over time, I think, you know, we've built a little bit of momentum, a little bit of comfort with people, you know, seeing this kind of thing. And now to the point where we have Redwoods Rising, you know, this huge restoration project. And so it's really changed over time. And I can say, you know, when I used to manage Headwaters, you know, the original thinnings that we did in these clear cut stands there were just different than we're doing now. So we were doing, you know, uniform spacing. It was like, okay, well, you know, here's a forest that's obviously too dense. We have a thousand trees, 2,000 trees per acre. And we're going to thin out to 15-foot spacing between the trees. And, you know, after that first thinning, we'd go back in 5-6 years and it's filled back in again. And we're not getting to that, taking it from a plantation back to a forest, right? So it's still uniform. It's still too dense. There's still not enough biodiversity. And so we've learned a lot over time. And the last time I was on the show 10 years ago, we were talking about this with Headwaters, how the next phase we're talking about, you know, opening things up a little bit more, creating that biodiversity, creating less uniform stands. You know, we've come a long way in building off of kind of the original kind of tinkering projects that had happened over the years. Now we're doing it at a larger scale.
You mentioned earlier carbon. This is something that we are all starting to become more familiar with, the desire, the need to have our forests sequester and safely store more carbon. Yeah. Redwood forests, fantastic. Old growth redwood, fantastic at sequestering carbon, right? A wonderful forest type for this reason. Can you talk about some of the research that the league has done about the role of this restoration work in putting on more carbon faster? You know, we're taking trees out, so it almost seems kind of in opposition to this goal. We're removing carbon to add more carbon faster.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the league funded this long-term science project called the Redwoods and Climate Change Initiative to understand the interaction between climate change and redwood forests. And, you know, what we found is redwood forests, coast redwood forests, hold more above ground carbon than any forest in the world, more than the Amazon rainforest, more than the Congo rainforest, more than the Pacific Northwest. There's more carbon. It's the most dense forest in the world, right? Most heaviest forest, I guess you could say. And the second, by the way, is Great Giant Sequoia Forest, which is kind of cool. What we've also found is that, older second growth redwood forests are some of the fastest at sequestering carbon, in the world. What we're doing with Redwoods Rising, we're kind of opening things up and we're taking some of that carbon out, right, to thin it out. So we have an initial drop in carbon, but what we found and through some of the research that we've done is that within 5 years on average, the amount of carbon in that forest is back to what it was before we thinned. So that's incredibly fast. And you can see that with redwoods, they're incredibly fast to resprout, right? So a tree that maybe just had, you know, it was just a straight skinny tree that had a green top, right? Just at the top. When you open things up a little bit, redwoods can resprout all along that bole. And they start sequestering carbon at a much faster rate on a per tree basis. And so, like I said, within 5, 6, 7 years, the forest is back to that level of carbon that was there pre-thinning. And we're doing some work right now with some researchers from Northern Arizona University to kind of play this out across the whole project using something called LIDAR. This is like, you know, lasers being shot from drones or airplanes, and they can measure above ground carbon using these tools. And so they're in the process right now of trying to scale up this data to something that we can report out for the whole Redwood National and State Park system. So next year we'll come out with that research, and it'll be really exciting to kind of see, you know, how the work that we're doing is setting the forest on kind of this different trajectory. So it's really exciting to kind of be able to be kind of a part of this. Of course, carbon isn't the only reason we're doing this, but it's like you said, you know, redwood forests are the best sequesterers of carbon, like the best technology we have, right, for sequestering carbon. People are tinkering with all these industrial ways to sequester carbon. And then we've got these trees that have been here for millions of years that are the best at doing this. And so it's really exciting to be part of that, too.
So quickly, we're running out of time. Wildlife considerations. What are the sorts of things that you do in planning a project like this or implementing a project to ensure that we continue to have good wildlife habitat in the stands after restoration?
Yeah. So we do lots of surveys before the work is done for all of the sensitive species, all the threatened and endangered species. So we have a really good idea of where they are. And then we have restrictions to certain times of year. So that we're not disturbing, you know, nesting birds and that sort of thing. So we have a relatively short window to do the work that we do at Redwoods Rising, for example. So, you know, it's really just like a 4-month time frame that we have to get a lot of work done. And so there's a lot of preparation that goes into that. So, you know, years of surveys, both biological resources and cultural resources, stream surveys to understand how our streams are functioning, and all of the kind of pre-survey work to understand, you know, where are we going to draw the lines on this restoration project and which roads are going to get pulled out and how much dirt is there that needs to be put somewhere else so that it doesn't, you know, leach into the stream. And so there's an incredible amount of work that goes just into that kind of preparatory work. So, you know, that's kind of the way we deal with it. And, you know, we're working with the second growth stands, so we're not working in areas that have marble murrelets, for example. So those are buffered and we have restrictions. We're not going to be working around those marble murrelet habitat areas. So it all kind of goes into this, you know, it's a multi-year pipeline to get to an actual implementation project on the ground.
And as I said, I went out recently and looked at some of the cut and I thought that you and your team have done a fantastic job. I'm excited to see more. I'm excited that you are continuing this good work. Thank you so much. If anyone has questions about restoration work through Save the Redwoods League or the Redwoods Rising program, where should they go?
Yeah, so feel free to reach out to me. You can go to our website, redwoodsrising.org, for more information. We've got a great TikTok page or an Instagram page also where videos are getting posted all the time. Griff Griffith is our social media superstar who posts videos on there where you can learn more about Redwoods Rising. And feel free to reach out to Save the Redwoods League through our website for any questions.
Ben, thank you so much for joining the show. It was 10 years, I guess, since we last had you. Let's not be strangers in that way again. Cool. Come on back.
Whenever you want me, Tom. Thanks.
All right. Good seeing you.
All right. Take care.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
All right, next we are going to travel from the Redwoods to Sacramento, and joining me is my friend and colleague Alex Loomer, consultant with Loomer Consulting. Hey, Alex.
Hey, Tom. Great to talk.
It's lovely to have you. So you work in Sacramento. You are one of those policy wonks that are in the halls of the legislature talking with legislators about what our environment needs. Maybe kind of introduce your work better than I am doing. Tell us about what it's like to be a policy consultant.
Well, you know, in these days, it's interesting. It's especially interesting. But yeah, just a little background on me. Like you, I'm an environmental attorney, but I have basically spent my entire career doing policy work. I've been doing first climate policy, then I did work on electric vehicles. And for the past 4 years now, I've been doing consulting work, basically only with environmental NGOs. This is the first year. I'm actually now working with the Karuk tribe, which has been so rewarding and really interesting to do. But yeah, most of my focus has really been in the conservation, water and, forest space. So kind of tracking all things policy related to those issues and looking at the budget too, you know, after the passage of Prop 4 and, you know, the kind of the influx of funding we're seeing for conservation work, we're really trying to make sure that those dollars are getting to the right places and we're getting the biggest bang for our buck with our investments.
So you already have mentioned the Karuk, one of your new clients. I know that you have a bill that's very near and dear to your heart that EPIC is also terribly excited about, AB 263. Let's talk about what this legislation would do, why we're supporting it, and maybe we can also give people some idea of how they can support it. So let's start at the beginning. What's the problem that the legislature needs to solve here?
So, you know, in the past handful of years, we've seen pretty dire conditions on the Scott and Shasta rivers. These are tributaries to the Klamath. And so, you know, we had great success with Klamath Dam removal. I think that was only the beginning, though. Like removing the dam, I think, was the first step in seeing like true success for that watershed restoration. We now need to make sure that these tributaries are able to, you know, withhold populations of salmon, coho. These are really keystone species. And since 2021, the Water Board has used their emergency powers under a drought declaration to put these bare minimum in-stream flows on the rivers just to ensure there's enough water in there to support these fish. You know, it's been pretty dire for anyone in the salmon fishing industry. This is the first, you know, few years we've had to close the commercial fishing season. The tribes, both, you know, that rely on these rivers, the Karuk, the Yurok, among others, have not been able to do ceremonial, fishing ceremonies because of the shortage of fish. And so we're really concerned about these populations. It's impacting the ecosystem, of course, but it's also really significant to the tribes and the fishing industries that are downstream. So last year, the State Water Board got funding in the budget to get two full-time staff to do long-term regulations, basically like do permanent in-stream flows on these rivers to ensure that we're getting enough protection for the waters. Indefinitely. You know, it's not just 1 year to 1 year. This is going to be kind of permanent going forward. but it's going to probably take them 3 to 5 years to get these regulations in place. You know, there's a whole process that goes into it. You get stakeholders, you have to do an economic analysis, a scientific analysis. And in the meantime, you know, these emergency regulations we have right now only last for 1 year. So we just got them renewed, but they're set to expire next February. And we're really concerned about losing these protections between now and when the permanent regulations are finalized. So AB 263 by Assemblymember Rogers would allow the current regulations that are on protecting these streams to stay in place until the long-term regs are finalized. And this is going to be critical to saving these fish. And when you think about the lifespan of the salmon, you know, it's not just 1 year to 1 year, but you really have to think about, you know, 3 years at a time. We're upholding these streams so that the salmon populations can thrive. And I was really impressed that this was Assemblymember Rogers' first bill. It was the very first bill he introduced, and it was really amazing to see him take this leadership. You know, the bill sponsored by the Yurok and the Karuk, along with California Coastkeeper Alliance. And I was so inspired to see that this was his priority. And I think it meant a lot to the tribes as well.
It certainly is a statement. You know, I think every legislative session, legislators, the first bill that they introduce that legislative session, they make to be some sort of a statement about their legislative priorities for the year. And so for him to have it not only for this legislative session, but his first bill overall to represent tribal communities in his district, it meant a ton to me as well. So Assemblymember Rogers, thank you so much. I doubt you're listening, but maybe you are. And we appreciate it. So 263, it's been introduced. Now tell us, you know, maybe this is a little bit, what's that old cartoon about, like, how a bill becomes a law?
Schoolhouse Rocks.
Yeah, Schoolhouse Rocks. Give us the Schoolhouse Rocks of, like, what comes next for 263? How will this, you know, knock on wood, become a law?
Yeah, so I had to learn this process when I started working in the legislature, and it really is very similar to Schoolhouse Rocks, if any of you have seen that. But it gets introduced, it's in print, and it gets assigned to a subject matter committee that's kind of specializing on water issues. So it's going to go to the Assembly Water Parks and Wildlife Committee first. I think it's only going to be assigned to that one subject matter committee, and then it'll go on to the Appropriations Committee just to analyze any costs. We actually see this as cost savings, because rather than the Water Board having to redo the emergency regs year after year, they can just kind of let it go for the next few years and really focus their energy on the long-term regs. Assuming it passes those two committees, it'll go to the Assembly floor. There's a vote on the floor with all members. If it makes it out of the floor, it's sent over to the Senate, and it's basically the same process there. It'll go to Senate Natural Resources and Water, Appropriations, Senate floor. And then, you know, assuming it passes both houses of the legislature, it'll be sent to Governor Newsom's desk. And you know, I'll just say that Governor Newsom has been such a great leader on, you know, helping the Klamath succeed. You know, that was a really huge success. And I think Governor Newsom and his staff were really key players in making that happen. So we're really hoping that he'll want to support the protections of the Scott and Shasta as well.
And it complements his salmon strategy that he released not too long ago as well. You know, he's been deeply invested, has come up to Indian country, has come to the Yurok Reservation, rode in dugout canoe. So I think that he understands the critical importance of salmon to this region and to our indigenous communities up here. We'll keep EPIC members, keep the general public informed on the progress of 263. If anyone wants to help support this, right? Because I imagine that there are going to be some interests in the Scott and Shasta Valleys that might not be terribly keen to have Sacramento in their business more. So I'm sure that this bill will always need support. How can people go about supporting this legislation?
Well, you know, I think as individuals, contacting your representatives and letting them know that this is important and that you're supportive. We'd also love to get more local governments, chambers of commerce, you know, on board. So we're really, like I said, seeing the impacts to the fishing industry, for the North Coast, like, this is really key to the local economies. So getting to elevate those voices would be great. So if you want to reach out to your local board of supervisors, your city council, your chamber of commerce, and see if they want to weigh in and support it, I think all of that would be really welcome.
All right. So SoHum Chamber of Commerce members, if you're listening right now, hit me up, tom@wildcalifornia.org. We'll get this done. We'll get a letter of support in from the SoHum Chamber. That would be cool. It'd be really neat to have the SoHum Chamber support this. I would love that.
Me too. I would really love that.
Let's do it. All right. So 263, you're watching. I'm watching just kind of the legislature in general. We have this interesting moment where DC is screwed up, right? We have Republican control of both houses and Trump in the White House, a deeply hostile administration to the environment. You know, one of the first things Trump does when he comes president is issues an executive order blaming radical environmentalists for fires in, or radical environmentalists in Northern California for fires in Southern California.
I'll say he also blamed Klamath Dam removal. And yes. So I want to note that there's been some very targeted attacks on our communities up north.
So we have things at risk, federal environmental laws at risk. It's a bad and bleak time. But when things are bad in DC, I often feel like our California legislature, our governor, rise to the occasion, and we have really good legislative sessions for the environment here. Can you talk about kind of the mood in Sacramento and maybe a feeling of, you know, we need to make sure California stays golden green because we can no longer count on federal environmental laws like the Endangered Species Act or NEPA or something?
Yeah, you know, I think this will be a really interesting session because while we do have that at the federal level, I think a lot of lawmakers also really heard from their voters that affordability and cost are also top of mind. So I think a lot of members are trying to figure out how to balance that. You know, when they opened special session back in December, that was like one of the first things that lawmakers were speaking to. But I think also, you know, this kind of California defense to what's being rolled back at the federal level will definitely be front of mind for a number of folks. We've already seen Assemblymember Schultz, who's from down in Southern California, introduce a bill that will help backstop, basically rollbacks on the wild and scenic rivers. And so we can, you know, try and be better at protecting anything that's losing protections at the federal level. We'll step up here in California. A couple of years ago, there was a really terrible Supreme Court decision, the Sackett decision, that rolled back protections on, you know, a lot of wetlands under the Clean Water Act. There's going to be a bill this year that will basically try and, you know, ensure that the state is stepping up and filling those gaps. So I think, yeah, there's definitely, you know, a number of lawmakers who are, that's at the forefront of their mind, is trying to be sure that we're not losing progress when it comes to our environmental laws. But, you know, I think there is a tension. There's environmental laws like the California Environmental Quality Act that is a process that you have to go through when you're developing, you know, housing and clean energy and, you know, any other development. And I think by a lot of developers, it's seen as, you know, cumbersome and time consuming and costly. But this is often the only opportunity that tribes and, you know, frontline communities have to weigh in on projects that are going to be going on in their backyard. And so I think it's more critical now than ever that we really uphold CEQA and be sure that we're defending it. But, you know, working on environmental laws every year, there are multiple bills that are trying to get around CEQA's requirements. And some of them, you know, I think there's room for conversation. Others, I think, you know, just go way too far, in my opinion, go way too far and really risk us losing ground, especially when we're risking the National Environmental Protection Act being rolled back at the federal level. We need to do everything we can to be sure we're defending the Coastal Act and CEQA and, you know, these kind of core fundamental laws in California.
We also, unfortunately, are going to probably have another bad budget for this year, right? Tax revenue drives the state and the tank is empty. Can you talk about the budget situation and how that might impact kind of this legislative session and the willingness for California to try and go and do cool things?
Yeah, I mean, I think Newsom has made it very clear in the past couple of years that he will veto bills that do not have a budget line item. If there's a cost to the bill that is not accounted for in the budget, we might be out of luck. So I think all policymakers and, you know, us advocates are really mindful of the cost of our bills. So, you know, going back to AB 263 as an example, we were so excited about this because we think it's going to save money. There's actually no price tag on it. And that's, I think that's going to be front of mind in a lot of these conversations. Like if there is not something in the budget, then you're going to have a really uphill battle, moving your bills forward. So that's, I think, going to be in every conversation about legislation this year. And the projections for the next couple of years are even worse. So it's not going to get better anytime soon unless things really turn around, which given the, I mean, bring us back to the federal level. I think that will have rippling effects on our local economies, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. On Sacramento, are there other things that you are excited about that you want to share? Other bills that are coming down the pike that are fantastic that you are wanting to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll say it's early, and I you know would love to come back in a couple months and talk more. The deadline to introduce bills is February 21st, so I think we still have honestly a lot of time to see in the next 10 days how many other bills are dropped. There is a new limit on how many bills legislators can introduce, and this is new, so I think we won't see quite as many bills. It won't be such a fire hose come introduction deadline, but for a 2-year session, members are limited to 35 bills. So I think we're mindful of that. And members, I think, are being a little bit more selective in what they introduce. But I think there's a number of environmental bills that I know are coming, but have not yet gone into print. So I won't get ahead of myself and speak to those. There are two that are in print that might not seem like environmental bills, but I think when you think about how connected everything is, this has been really top of mind for me. And I wish excited is not the word I'm going to use to describe them because it's really a crisis. But there's two bills that have been introduced so far to help address the missing and murdered Indigenous people. This crisis that we have in California. And I mean, this is going to be a huge priority for the tribes. One of these bills was run last year and they're going to give it another go this year. So I'll just describe these two briefly. And I think, the reason this has been top of mind for me working in the environmental space is I think realizing the more holistic picture than when you have had, really centuries of white people, degrading the environment, our rivers are running dry, our forests are really not being protected the way they should be. These have rippling effects on the communities that live near these resources. And I think in a lot of the tribal communities, this has impacted their local economies. This has impacted public health measures. And the stats that I've read recently about the missing and murdered Indigenous people in California are mind-blowing. We have the fifth largest caseload in the nation. Nationwide, more than 4 out of 5 Native Americans have experienced violence in their lifetime, and more than 1 in 3 have in the last year. 1 out of 130 Native American children are likely to go missing each year. I mean, these stats, I think for anyone who has children, is probably gut-wrenching. And, this is compared to any other group, I mean, this really blows it out of the water. So we know that there's a huge problem here. We need to address it. So there's two bills that have been introduced that are going to try and help these communities address MMIP. So one is by Samira Ramos, it's AB 31, which would establish a pilot program basically that would allow tribal law enforcement officers to have authority that the California peace officers do, so they could do better enforcement on tribal and other lands. And then SB 4 by Senator Cervantes would establish a missing and murdered Indigenous persons justice program at the Department of Justice. And this would facilitate collaboration between tribal victims' families, tribal governments, federal, state, out-of-state law enforcement agencies, really, you know, create more collaboration in solving these cases. And many of them are these are involving human trafficking. So this is really something that needs to be addressed, you know, at all levels of law enforcement. So I think both of those are going to be huge. I would really love to see, you know, more of the environmental community stand side by side with the tribes and, you know, support these bills. I think this is all, it's all connected, and we're starting to see that more and more.
This also makes me reflect on some of the concerns that have been raised in offshore wind. With a renewable energy development project, it raises the risks of bringing outsiders into our community who can prey upon vulnerable populations. And so this has been a conversation that we've had at EPIC with tribes and with other groups about how can we ensure that offshore wind, if it is done in such a way that it wouldn't further exacerbate this problem. You know, as you said, California is unfortunately one of the kind of leaders here in MMIP cases. Humboldt County within California is, you know, I believe the worst or the second worst county for MMIP cases. So this is a big and dire problem for our Indian communities up here.
Yeah. Yeah. So I love that you guys have been thinking about that. This has really been front of mind for me. And, you know, I think just in all things advocacy, Tom, I know you know this, it's so important to have a big tent, and you don't just have one voice. Like, you know, on environmental issues, you don't just want environmental groups up there saying this is important. You really want to build a big coalition of diverse interest, and they can all kind of echo that same message. And that gets a lot further when you're in Sacramento trying to influence lawmakers. So, you know, to the extent that we can, I think it's really important that we stand side by side with the tribes in these priorities around MMIP.
Absolutely. Well, Alex, you have my permission here. Everyone can hear on the radio to sign up on to support letters for both of these
awesome
bills.
Thank you
for running them and for doing all this work. I want to take a second to talk again about the budget, because I remembered we have some good news, which is in the last election, we passed a climate bond. Tell us about Prop 4 and all the good things that we're going to do. And
crazy.
All
it could not have been more timing. So yeah, this is huge. The voters, by, you know, 60% of voters supported Prop 4, which is going to provide $10 billion of funding to a really, you know, diverse set of environmental priorities, from safe drinking water to wildfire resilience to, you know, outdoor access in parks, to sustainable agriculture, really kind of to biodiversity, and, you know, 30 by 30, which I know we've talked about in the past. And it's really critical that we have these funds coming now, especially with the budget crisis. Like, we're really going to need to rely on the Prop 4 dollars. And so kind of going through the same, you know, process that we talked about with the legislature. Now for the budget, you know, the kind of process that we're seeing now is the governor's put out his proposed budget, like how he envisions spending these dollars. And the way he's laid it out is like, what are we going to do this year? What are we going to do next year? And then what are we kind of saving for the quote unquote out years, which I translate into like post Newsom, because he only has two more years left. So what are we going to do now versus, you know, after his administration? And so now it's really the chance for the legislature to weigh in. So the governor kicks off the conversation with his kind of proposal in January, and then it's really the ball's in the legislature's court, and they will have budget committee hearings over the next few months. They have subcommittees devoted specifically to natural resources and climate. And so those committees are going to be doing a deep dive on how they want to be investing these dollars. They're really interested to hear from advocates and, you know, hear from all of us about where we think the dollars should be going and how much should be going there. I don't think it's a huge secret that, you know, Governor Newsom actually did not really engage in the bond. He did not publicly support it, but the legislature really, I think, carried that torch. Senator McGuire is actually the one who, you know, Pro Tem McGuire, who's your senator, is actually the one who signed the bond into law before sending it to the voters. And he really played a critical role. Like, it was pretty incredible seeing how Pro Tem McGuire brought together all of his colleagues in the Senate, really got consensus on the issues. And, you know, there was no question about it passing. Like, he really got everyone on board. And so, you know, it's really now, like, I think going to be interesting to see the legislature start to weigh in after they put so much work into shaping the bond. Let's hear from them and see where they want these dollars to touch down. Not to speak for him, but I can imagine that Pro Tem McGuire will be excited to see some of these dollars touch down in his district, and, you know, see the benefits of Prop 4, you know, in his communities. I know that's really important to him.
So once again, there's money for fire resilience in there. So doing work around communities to make them more fire safe. There's money in there for offshore wind port development. There's money in there for specifically directed at indigenous communities to try to do sustainable, equitable development. There's a lot of things that are directed for the North Coast, frankly. I think it's quite helpful to us that Pro Tem McGuire was the person doing these negotiations, because he was keeping an eye out for our community in this bill. So measure. So I'm excited. I really appreciate everybody who voted for it. I believe we talked about Prop 4 previously on this show prior to the election. So good job, everybody. We did it. We're over the line. And now let's go make our state as sustainable as possible.
I can give one example, Tom, of something that I think would be a really awesome project for the bond. You know, the cool thing about the bond is that, like, it's bringing all these different buckets together that I think some, you know, projects can be kind of checking multiple boxes. So the Karuk tribe has a fire resiliency training center that they have envisioned that they'd really love to build on their ancestral lands. And it would be a training center. So we could do, you know, train more people across the state, across the nation to do cultural burning, prescribed burning, which is really, you know, the proactive management of our forests that we should be doing. It would be a community resilience center. So in times of, like, extreme disasters, smoke, heat, anything like that, communities could come there for shelter. It'll have food sovereignty elements. So it helps support food sovereignty within the community. It'll be a clean air refuge. So this is the type of project that we're so excited to see funded by the bond that, you know, is going to really help local communities, but also have impacts, you know, throughout the state and really have benefits far reaching. It's things like that I'm excited to have ribbon cutting. It'll be really fun to see these bond dollars touching down in our communities.
We have just a little bit of time left. Maybe we could do a little bit of gossiping about what's going on in Sacramento. Is there any hot goss? What's the tea these days in Sacramento?
Oh, I wish I had really good gossip. I think what I find hot gossip is pretty boring to the average listener. But, I think there's the biggest thing, and this is not really gossip, but is we have 35 new members, I think roughly about 30, somewhere in there, new members. So this is a big chance for, like, a lot of new folks, including Senator Rogers, who is new to the legislature, to come in and kind of make their mark. And I think that's kind of what's going to be exciting, is seeing all these new members coming in and what their priorities are going to be.
On these members, is there anybody that you're personally excited about working with or that you think has a good promise to help be an environmental champion moving forward?
I'll say my top three. Obviously I'm biased. Samir Rogers is my number one. Obviously he's out of the gate, you know, been a great champion. Senator McNerney is coming in from kind of the Delta area. He was actually he was in Congress for the last, I don't know, many years, but he's come down to state government. And I think it's just so nice to have someone who's lived the life in DC coming down to California and kind of, like, bringing lessons learned. He has a really long history in energy policy and working for energy companies. He really cares about water issues. He has a great chief of staff who used to be in Senator Skinner's office. She was great. And then she was actually chief of staff to the director of the Energy Commission. So he's got a great team, and I think Senator McNerney is going to do some really great stuff. Asamira Ransom is also similar area, kind of Delta-ish, seems super progressive. You know, she's one of the few members when I was looking at her campaign website that talked about water, which, you know, for me, I was really excited about. So I'm curious to see kind of what she does. And then Assemblymember Schultz, who I mentioned has the Wild and Scenic Rivers bill, he stepped in where Assemblymember Friedman had been. So big shoes to fill. She was a huge environmental champion, but I think, you know, he's already kind of off to a great start. He has a great staffer. His legislative director worked for Assemblymember Friedman and has been, you know, a longtime advocate on environmental issues before going into the building. So those are kind of my top members that I'm really excited about. But I think there's many more, and I look forward to learning about like the other new members who are going to come in and do great things.
For sure. Well, unfortunately, Alex, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining me on the KMUD Environment Show. We got to have you back later in the legislative session to hear how things are going and what we should
I'd
be
love that.
Championing for.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.